Well, thank you very much indeed, Dr. Block, for your kind welcome and your very warm words, which are going to be a bit hard to live up to. And thanks very much for coming out, everyone, tonight. I've been enjoying my stay here so far, and it's a privilege to have this chance to say a little bit more about my great enthusiasm about the book of Deuteronomy. My title introduces the topic, Deuteronomy and Justification, a Justification of Deuteronomy. Well, there's a little joke there. It's one of those titles that you come up with, you know, and you think that would be a good title. And then you come to write the lecture. And maybe the title doesn't seem like such a good idea anymore, but I'll tell you what I meant by it. Deuteronomy can be perceived to be a problem in biblical theology, a liability to the Bible, because of some of the features of it. It seems to be very nationalistic. Here you have God's command to the people of Israel to go and occupy this land and drive out all the people who are minding their own business and living their lives in that land at that particular time. And that's a hard thing for many people to understand. I know when I talk to church groups and so on about the Old Testament, that's almost always the first question. Did God really tell the Israelites to go and do that? You know, here's a problem. And one can, at the very least, call that a kind of nationalism. Is that what Deuteronomy is really promoting? And then, of course, it is often regarded as legalistic. For example, you get many statements in the book of Deuteronomy which command that the people shall keep God's commandments. And sometimes, of course, that's natural and what we'd expect, but sometimes it seems that they must keep the commandments in order that they may enter the land that he's giving to them. If you look at, just to take an example, chapter 6, verses 17 to 18. We really only need 18. Do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord, so that it may go well with you, so that you may go in and occupy the good land that the Lord swore to your ancestors to give you. Is that the order? Is that the way in which this thing works? Do you obey the commands first and then enter into the promise of God? You can see the point, can't you, that Deuteronomy seems to advocate the very things that the New Testament then denies, namely that the people of God is a nation, a particular nation, when the gospel is for all nations, and also that the gospel is a gospel of grace and not a matter of law. Well, of course, I'm setting this thing up in order to knock it down, as you can understand, but, you know, this is the way in which the book is often perceived. Deuteronomy has become, in much Old Testament scholarship, a kind of a cipher or a symbol of everything that is unenlightened in theology. If you read in the critical literature of the Old Testament, that the terms deuteronomic and deuteronomistic are frequently used, not only of the book itself, but of other parts of the Old Testament, and very often they are used in such a way as to disparage a particular part of the Old Testament. If you've read about the book of Jeremiah, for example, you'll know that scholars very often distinguish between the poetic oracles of the book of Jeremiah and the prose parts. And usually that's in favor of the poetic oracles and to the disadvantage of the prose parts. Indeed, people sometimes say the rudest things about the prosaic parts of the book of Jeremiah. They call it dull and boring and poor in thought, and all manner of things that you can imagine are said about those parts that are called deuteronomistic. And so you have this concept that's around about the Deuteronomists as being narrow, sort of second-rate theologians who perpetuate all of these, all of this bad theology. The book of Job as well is often regarded as being a kind of antidote to the legalism of Deuteronomy. So there is this spirit abroad. Now, if all that's right, if these are correct perceptions of the justification, I don't think for a moment that these are correct perceptions of the book, but there are people who think so. Well, I want to say that Deuteronomy is deeply misunderstood when it is perceived in this way. And rather than it being a liability to biblical theology, it is at the heart of biblical theology. And there are things about this book which we need to understand in order to do biblical theology in a fully rounded way. I think, indeed, Deuteronomy provides the foundation for the doctrine of justification by faith. We'll come to that in due course. And therefore, of course, that it's not legalistic. And also, it provides the foundation for the extension of God's justice and salvation to all nations. And therefore, it's not nationalistic. So these are the things that I want to try to demonstrate to you by making a number of points. I want us to look, first of all, at Deuteronomy chapter 4. And to have in mind, and this is really my first point by way of trying to demonstrate to you that Deuteronomy is really a very good thing and not a very bad thing, the transcendence of Yahweh, the name of the Lord, the transcendence of Yahweh and the universality of justice. The transcendence of Yahweh and the universality of justice. Now, the text to begin with here is chapter 4, verse 7, where Moses is describing the laws of God. This whole chapter really is about the laws and the instruction that God gives to the people via Moses. And we read here in verse 7, this is Moses speaking. For what other great nation has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is whenever we call on him? The Lord is near to his people Israel. Now that's an important concept. It means that he is present. He is not a distant God. He is not transcendent only. Do you know what I mean by transcendent? It means that he is not confined on earth. Transcendent means, if you like, he is in heaven. He comes to earth from beyond us, if you like. That's clearly a very important truth about God. But also he is immanent. He is here with us, and that's one of the things that is being said there in chapter 4, verse 7. He is immanent in his Torah. He is immanent in his word. That's how he is near, by means of his word. But he is also transcendent in his power in creation and history. And that becomes clear more towards the end of chapter 4, verses 32 to 34. Verse 32, you read, where shall we start? For ask now about former ages, long before your own, ever since the day that God created human beings on the earth. Ask from one end of heaven to the other, has anything so great as this ever happened, or has its like ever been heard of? Here is God, the creator, God whose sphere is the whole of creation, heaven and earth. And verse 36 is important because it brings together heaven and earth there too. From heaven, he made you hear his voice. That's a reference to him speaking on Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb. And on earth, he showed you his great fire while you heard his words coming out of the fire. These two things are then asserted about God in this chapter. He is immanent and he is transcendent. And in his universality, if you like, his Torah becomes universal. Or at least there is a beginning of that trend in Deuteronomy. I want us, we'll find that we need to look further for a continuation of it in the Old Testament. But this is really my first point, that the Torah that God reveals to his people Israel, I'm using Torah simply because it's the Hebrew word that is used in the chapter. It means his instruction and the laws and commandments that he gives. It's a very general word within the book of Deuteronomy for the teaching and the laws that God gives to Israel through Moses. But Torah contradicts idolatry. Now, this is a rather important point about the structure of chapter 4. I've said to you that Torah is the means by which God is present in the world. And that's developed, really, in the first half of chapter 4. I hope you have a Bible that you can look at just to see this. Particularly in verses 9 to 14, you have a memory of Israel gathered at Mount Horeb to receive, to hear the word of God that he gives them. Horeb, Sinai, and you remember the Ten Commandments, which are given there, 4:13. He declared to you his covenant, which he charged you to observe. That is the Ten Commandments, and he wrote them on two stone tablets. And the Lord charged me at that time to teach you statutes and ordinances. That seems to refer to the other laws that are given in addition to the Ten Commandments, all of which add up to the Torah, if you like. Now, that's the way in which it's present. But then you see verse 15, and down to verse 19, you have a passage which shows that God is not present in images. Israel knows God in the Torah, not through idolatrous images. Verse 15 says, since you saw no form when the Lord spoke to you at Horeb, be careful, and I'm abbreviating, not to corrupt yourselves by making an idol for yourselves in any form. And that continues down to verse 19, 20. These two things are being brought together. The Lord is present in his word. He is not present in an idol. Idols were a means of trying to make God present, or at least trying to express the presence of God. That's what the nations who had images and idols thought they were doing when they made them. They were expressing the presence of the God that they were worshiping. Now, you know that, of course, that is one of the central tenets of biblical theology, that you cannot make an image of God. And here is kind of a reason being given for that, that the Lord is not present in that way, that is, as if he could be contained somehow, or located, or caught within the created order that he himself has created, but rather he is present by his free will, by his decision to address a people and speak to them and give them his commandments. He does retain his freedom as he does that. But also there is this tendency for, there is this capacity for his word to become universal, to move out, to move on and to move out from the place where he has given his word at first, which is to Israel at Horeb. There are two ways in which the Torah moves out from there. One is through the generations, because the people of Israel are to teach the commandments and the Torah to their children and to their children's children. That's a recurring theme, comes a couple of times in chapter 4. You get it in chapter 6, and indeed other places too. The Torah expresses the rule of God in the world for all time, and it moves out of Israel, because Israel's possession of the Torah in God's sovereign gift is observed by the other nations. That was the point there in verse 7. And also verse 8, what other great nation has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is whenever we call him? That's verse 7. Then verse 8, perhaps more to this point, and what other great nation has statutes and ordinances as just as this entire law that I'm setting before you this day? So there's the Torah that is given to Israel, and it's a just law. That's important. The word is tzaddik there, for those of you who know Hebrew. And this is seen by the other nations. There's a witness element in this. And so God, in giving Torah to Israel, is doing something that expresses his universal sovereignty, his claim upon all the nations. Well, that's the beginning of that theme, really, in Deuteronomy. As I said a moment ago, that we need to move on from Deuteronomy to get a fuller picture. I want just to cross-refer at this point to a passage in Isaiah. A couple of passages in Isaiah. Isaiah, first of all, chapter 2, verses 2 to 4. Just following up this idea of the universality of Torah, this is the picture of all the nations paying or going on pilgrimage to Mount Zion, to Jerusalem, in order to learn the Torah. Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth Torah, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. That's one text. And then I am coming back to Deuteronomy, but I want to look first of all at Isaiah 51, verses 4 to 6, where a number of these, the elements that we saw in Deuteronomy, are taken up in this new connection. Now, you're well aware, I'm sure, that the book of Isaiah is very interested in the salvation of the nations, especially chapters 40 to 55. So much so that Isaiah is often contrasted with Deuteronomy. To go back to that negative characterization of Deuteronomy that I began with, you know, where it's supposed to be nationalistic, Isaiah, on the other hand, is supposed to be very much in favor of all the nations. The servant of the Lord is a light to the nations. You remember that, Isaiah 42, Isaiah 49. Here you have another passage which expresses something of this. 51, 4 to 6, listen to me, my people, give heed to me, my nation, for a teaching will go out from me, a Torah, and my justice for a light to the peoples. That's where that is the word mishpat. It doesn't actually come in Deuteronomy 4, but it's always connected with Torah and with righteousness, which we did notice back there. And then I will bring near my deliverance swiftly. And that's interesting because that is the word for justice or righteousness, but now meaning deliverance when applied to the nations. It's a rather curious thing about the righteousness of God, his tzedakah, which expresses fundamentally his love of what is right and his desire for right relationship among people. It's the quality that underlies all justice. But it curiously can come to mean salvation or deliverance. This is a point of contact with the New Testament, which we might come back to. But the revelation of God's justice is actually an act of salvation. Well, now, I'm making this connection between Deuteronomy and Isaiah because I'm really wanting to say to you that the fundamental ideas that are developed in this passage are already there back in Deuteronomy 4, in the sense of the universality of Torah, and the witness of Torah to the nations. Well, let's just sum up on that section. The gift of Torah to Israel is part of Yahweh's movement towards the nations. The special place of Israel, which is undeniable in Deuteronomy, has a purpose which involves the nations. Now, you might think that there is a certain tension in that. I think there is a certain tension. I'm not saying contradiction, because it's not that. But there's something, I suppose, paradoxical about this, that God's purpose for the whole world begins in a special purpose for one people. And this belongs to the theology of election in the Old Testament, which is very prominent, of course, in Deuteronomy itself. Well, the movement towards the nations is not realized fully in Deuteronomy. One needs to go to Isaiah for that. One needs to go finally onto the New Testament for that. But I think we've seen that, at the very least, the function of Torah in Deuteronomy is not a legalistic thing. Israel must keep Torah in order to possess its land. There's a much bigger concept of Torah than that in the book of Deuteronomy. And it also is clear that we don't have a narrow nationalism down in the book of Deuteronomy, but rather a Torah. It's actually called a wisdom in Deuteronomy 4, verses 6 to 8. Did you notice that? That is valid for all nations. So there are these two poles, Israel and the nations on the one Israel on the one hand, the nations on the other hand. And but it does need to be affirmed that Israel has or had a special role. It had an inevitable role. The Lord, as it were, needed Israel in order to pursue his purposes for the whole world. And I want us just to reflect for a moment on this idea of the election of Israel. The election of Israel. What is it for? Now, our key text for that, we move on from Deuteronomy 4 to Deuteronomy 7. This is where you have the command to the people of Israel to go in and take possession of the land, drive out the other nations. You get that in verses 1 to 5. And then in 7:6, you have the reason for that command. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on earth to be his people, his treasured possession. There's another passage in chapter 26 which talks about Israel being set on high above all the other nations. So Israel is singled out. You are a people holy to the Lord your God. Do you see how holiness is in parallel with chosenness here? So that they almost come to mean the same thing in this rhetoric of the book of Deuteronomy. This is the heart of that theology that, as I said to you at the beginning, some people find it rather hard to understand. Why should this be? Why should the Lord favor this one people as opposed to all these other peoples, and indeed drive out the other peoples in order to bring these people into their land? I want to suggest to you that this also can be understood in terms of the Lord's ultimate purpose. The Lord gave Israel a land in order for that to become an arena within which his justice could be demonstrated. Law and land, I seem to remember making this point a little earlier in the day to the other group that I was speaking to. Law and land go very closely together. If you think of it, that's true in any context. Where is a law valid? It's valid within a certain space. It requires a place where it can be enacted and indeed handed on. We talk about the law of the land, and that's not accidental. So there is a certain necessity that Israel should have an arena within which it can demonstrate to the nations what a relationship with God is like. Some people have referred to Deuteronomy as a counterculture. That is, why does Israel drive out these other nations? What's the real point of this? The point is that this somehow symbolizes God's counterculture. That's all summed up or brought together in the command to worship him at the place that he will choose. I'm now in chapter 12, where you have the worship command, which is a very central command in the book of Deuteronomy. You shall seek the place the Lord your God will choose to put his name there. I abbreviate the formula. And that's in contrast, that's a place of worship. Seek the place that the Lord will choose for Israel to worship him. And that's in contrast to the places where the nations previously have worshipped God. You've got to destroy their places of worship. You not only drive them out, you destroy their places of worship and all the trappings of worship in those places, and you seek the place the Lord will choose to worship him. There is a very clear and direct contrast made between the worship that the Lord requires of himself in his place and the worship that the nations had practiced of their gods in those places. The thing is a complete alternative, a radically new thing that is a sort of mirror image of what had been going on before. Not in the sense that it's the same, because it's precisely not the same, it's different. It's the worship of Yahweh. This is a counterculture, and one has to understand the idolatrous worship practices of the nations as representing a kind of corrupt culture. The worship of false gods affects the whole character of a society. The worship of the true God is a prerequisite of a truly based society. And I think that there are all sorts of possibilities for applying that in a modern time to the church's witness to the world. The church advocates, the church is a kind of alternative society to the worldliness that is all around. There is a critique of culture here. That's the really important thing. That's the thing that we can get hold of here and make valid and relevant in our own thinking, in our own lives. It's almost a sort of missiological point. That might seem curious, because on the face of it, Deuteronomy doesn't seem like very promising material for missiology. Here you have a command to go in and drive out all these nations, and of course I'm putting it mildly when I say drive out. They're supposed to kill these people, you know. As you will have noticed, there is a certain ambivalence within the book about whether they're really supposed to kill them, and it's frequently pointed out, isn't it? Chapter 7, verse 2 says, you must utterly destroy them, make no covenant with them, and show them no mercy. And then verse 3 goes, and do not intermarry with them, which seems at least to reduce the goal somewhat, doesn't it? You know, you must kill these people, and what's more, you mustn't marry any of them. There is a kind of, now this is all part of the rhetoric of the book of Deuteronomy. I mean, it's not that Moses forgot what he said in verse 2 when he wrote verse 3. There is a sort of a realism about this. So the real point is that you don't go around, I mean, there's clearly no mandate here for holy war. I mean, I simply say that. It's impossible to have a theology of holy war in the light of the New Testament. So how do you make this kind of theology relevant in a modern age? It is by seeing this as a mandate for critiquing the dominant culture, whatever form that might take, and you critique it by being the people of God and expressing the standards of God. And that's something that the church can hear, just as Israel was able to hear it in the old days. Well, that's the first point, really, about election, that it implies a critique of culture. I want to make a further point about election, the election of Israel, and that is that it is not absolute. It is not something, and I'm speaking about the theology of the book of Deuteronomy and indeed other parts of the Old Testament, it is not something that is a once for all, irrevocable given. Now, that ought to be clear enough from the prophets who are constantly berating Israel for taking the promises of God for granted. You look at the temple sermon in Jeremiah 7. Jeremiah standing at the gate of the temple. This was no easy thing to do. It was some feast occasion. Hundreds and thousands of people pouring to the temple to participate in this feast. And poor Jeremiah standing at the gate, telling them all that what they were doing was false. And the essence of his message is, look, you can't simply assume that because you have a grand temple here, the Lord is always going to be present here. He had destroyed the temple at Shiloh beforehand. He could do the same to the temple at Jerusalem. He could send his people into exile. One cannot assume, and indeed, by the time Jeremiah is speaking, a large part of the people of Israel has already gone into exile and never to return. He's already speaking to a rump of the elect people of Israel. So whatever election means, it doesn't mean that this people is guaranteed once for all in its entirety to be the elect people of God. Now, it is sometimes said that Deuteronomy has got a theology of holiness and election that is absolute because of what is said in 7:6. You are a people holy to the Lord your God. And because there is no conditional clause in there. That's in contrast to Exodus 19, verse 5, where you do, in a similar passage, have an if clause. If you obey my voice and keep my covenant, then I don't want to misquote Exodus 19, 5, so I'll just go back to that. If you obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession out of all the peoples. It's a rather significant if clause, which you don't have in Deuteronomy 7:6. However, one can't simply focus on that one verse, because it seems to me that chapter 7 of Deuteronomy stands against this idea. That is to say, that once that election is an absolute, a given for all time. Because look at verses 9 to 11. Know therefore that the Lord your God is God, the faithful God, who maintains covenant loyalty with who? The whole people of Israel? With those who love him and keep his commandments to 1,000 generations. And in contrast, who repays in their own person those who reject him. He does not delay, but repays in their own person those who reject him. Therefore, observe diligently the commandment, the statutes and the ordinances that I am commanding you today. So the affirmation that Israel is a holy people, is the holy people of God, runs immediately on to this, this concept of covenant loyalty between Yahweh and a faithful people. And it turns into command, therefore obey. Now, none of these things can be prized apart. And verses 9 to 11 are actually chiastically structured so as to bring out this need for a relationship between Yahweh and Israel even more strongly. Well, Israel cannot presume upon its elect status. And I think one might even turn back to chapter 6, verses 24 and 25, the immediate prelude to chapter 7. And once again, the observer said, fear for lasting good. Once again, the idea of tzedakah comes in there, the idea of righteousness. There's a nice balance there between the blessings of God and righteousness in those two verses just prior to chapter 7. in my version, it comes, the idea of tzedakah comes in the phrase, we will be in the right. You might have a version that does it differently from that. But that's certainly the concept. So that, you know, that's the immediate prelude to this theology of election. God is looking for a people that will express his righteousness. There's something dynamic, there's something purposeful about his election of Israel. Well then, we go on to the next point. We've got this idea that God has a purpose for the nations. In order to achieve it, he chooses Israel to be a kind of counterculture and a witness to the nations. Now we hit a problem. And I suppose it's already been intimated in our look at chapter 7, where we see that people of God, faithful people of God, does not necessarily equate with external nation. And in fact, we find that Israel fails to keep covenant. And it seems to be even worse than that, in a sense. It's not just that, in fact, Israel fails, but Israel seems to be constitutionally incapable of keeping covenant. That's the point in chapter 9, verses 4 to 6. When the Lord your God thrusts out the other nations before you, do not say to yourself, it's because of my righteousness that the Lord has brought me in to occupy this land. There's tzedakah again. It's not. It's because of the wickedness of the nations that he's driving them out. And then it's repeated in verse 5, not because of your righteousness. Because, reading on to verse 6, you are a stubborn people. It's laid on a bit thick in those verses. It's made very, very clear to Israel that they are not occupying the land because of any righteousness of their own. Now, there's a problem, isn't it? Because God's point in choosing Israel is to demonstrate his righteousness through their righteousness, if you like, in the eyes of the world. But here's Israel, and it is not righteous. What's going on here? You know, the whole point of a covenant relationship is that the people ought to be able to keep the covenant. And the gift of the land is with the intention that this people should keep the covenant. But even before they're allowed near the land, the Lord is already saying, you're not righteous. Now, this is not legalism, is it? There's no legalism here. Here is the other side of the story. This has got to be laid alongside I quoted you a verse, didn't I, right at the beginning? It was chapter 6, verse 18, which said, you must keep the commandments in order to go into the land. This looks like a complete reversal of that. You're going into the land, but don't think that you've got any righteousness about you. You haven't. I'm only giving it to you because that lot are so bad. You know. So here's a real problem. What becomes of this wonderful concept that Israel should demonstrate to the world what God's society is like? I want just to... This is where we get very close to this idea of justification. Because I wanted to look again at the terminology in these verses, and I want to change it slightly. Going back to verse 4, well, let's take verse 5, because that has all the vocabulary I want. There's lots of repetition here. It is not because of your innocence or the uprightness of your heart that you are going in to occupy their land, but because of the guilt of these nations before the Lord. Just changing that translation slightly, I don't know if any of you is looking at a translation that actually uses those terms. What's my reasoning for doing that? The words are tzedakah and rish'ah, which can be translated righteousness and wickedness. But I'm suggesting that we might be able to use a more forensic kind of metaphor or translation here, innocence and guilt. This is really on the basis of chapter 25, verse 1, which comes from a part of the law code. Suppose two persons have a dispute and enter into litigation, and the judges decide between them, declaring the one to be in the right and the other to be in the wrong. The one to be, if you like, innocent and the other to be guilty. And that's the same language. It's tzedakah and rish'ah, or related vocabulary. So there's a case for saying here that what the Lord is actually saying to Israel is that they are not innocent before him and that the other nations are guilty. And you can see the line here to justification, can't you? If Israel is not innocent, well, then it has no right, if you like, to stand before the Lord. It has no right to expect blessings from the Lord. And yet, he is proposing to give them those blessings, to give them salvation. This point is actually made in the commentary of Braulich on Deuteronomy, which is rather remarkable, because Braulich's a Catholic scholar, a German Catholic scholar, and he's interpreting this text in a way that looks very Protestant, you know, very Lutheran, and the world has changed into the 16th century. But this line is pursued in pursuit of the idea of the Lord's justification, of tzedakah as something very close to deliverance. You didn't have your own tzedakah, if you like. But the Lord, nevertheless, gives you his blessings. Now, there may then be a line that we can take from that text to that one that I quoted earlier on, Isaiah 51, verses 4 to 6, where tzedakah was precisely deliverance. Here is where Deuteronomy comes very close to the idea of justification, a Pauline sense. I think there are other Old Testament texts that one can quote in this connection as well. But it's rather important, isn't it? Israel doesn't enter the land because of its right to do so. Rather, the reverse. It enters the land purely by God's decision to give it his blessings. Now, we might just pursue this a little bit further. This idea, I think incidentally, this fact doesn't take away from the fact that Israel is commanded to do God's will. Israel is still under the obligation to keep the covenant. Now here's something that we can't logically tie up. We can't tie the ends of this up. But the fact that Israel is found to be guilty beforehand, at the outset, doesn't actually take away from the force of all the commands that are given to it. There is still a vision here in the book of Deuteronomy and all these commandments, all the laws that occupy the great middle part of the book, for a people that is living according to God's way and not according to the ways of the nations. And one has almost got to read the book of Deuteronomy aloud in order to hear this point. Of course, one can light in on various texts like this and say, oh, look, it doesn't look as if Israel is actually able to do this, and you come up with a theology of Israel's innate sinfulness, if you like, and incapacity to keep God's will. And that's all very right and true. But when you actually listen to the book and read it and allow the rhetoric to have the effect on you that it's meant to have on you, then you hear command after command after command, and you get the strong impression you're meant to do this, you know. That we, if we can slip in the we for Israel here, we hear the promise of God, we receive the promise of God, not because of any capability that we have of being righteous. It's entirely by grace. But yet we're commanded to be righteous. It's hard to get away from this theme in Deuteronomy. This is a theme that I'm taking up tomorrow in another lecture, but it's at the heart of it. That's the role of Israel. But the book looks always to the future. And this is true if we come back to chapter 12 for a moment or two. You shall seek the place that the Lord will choose to put his name there, worship him there. Very important, I think, to understand that the book of Deuteronomy is not looking at a single point in history, which is the end of the line. Israel's got to get into the land, it's got to find this place, it's got to get the temple built in Jerusalem, of course, and that's it. We were talking about this a little earlier in another place as well, so I just mention it briefly now and almost incidentally. Rather, that vision there, and this is a very, this is a recurring motif in the book of Deuteronomy, this idea of a place where the Lord will place his name. The point of it is not that at some particular time Israel will have arrived, but rather that it is always incumbent upon God's people to meet him truly in worship and to be truly his people. And the concept here has the capacity to invite us, I'm using us again for Israel, again and again and again, into relationship with him, into covenant with him. And that can happen in ever new situations. There's a sort of open-endedness about this vision. And ultimately, of course, it will lead to the inclusion of other nations. And ultimately, this happens in Christ. Christ becomes the place, if you like, where we come to meet God. And it becomes very inclusive, totally inclusive. So again, no national righteousness in all of this. If I can just sum up the train of thought up to this point, there is no national righteousness here after all. The election of Israel is not about this being the chosen people. Now, this is such a dangerous topic that one always feels drawn to qualify. I haven't been pursuing this line in order to disparage Israel. That's not the point. Because one might as well disparage anyone. I see Israel as in a sense representative of human beings before God, representative of human capacities to be faithful, to keep covenant. Now there's a real historical line here, which leads to the church universal, if you like, a real historical line that begins with Israel and ends in the church. But the relationship between Israel and church is very, very complicated and subtle, I think. And it's not right to disparage historic Israel. And certainly not right to end up with a theology which looks down on the Jews as a people. That's not where I'm leading with this. God's purpose began with Israel and becomes universal. That's inclusive. That includes Israel. There's a certain sense in which synagogue is even a witness to church as an evidence of God's work in the world and as an evidence of grace. And I think it's right that the church, the Christian church, needs to be humble in relation to the synagogue. It's a reminder of who we are and what we're like. Have we any righteousness of our own? No. That was a little unanticipated digression on that. I'm going to finish now very quickly by just completing this point that election, the role of Israel, is not a final thing, is not a limited thing, but indeed that there is even an eschatological dimension in the vision of the book of Deuteronomy. And one of the pointers to this comes, oddly enough, in the laws. The laws occupy a large part of the book of Deuteronomy. They're not the parts that you naturally go to, probably for edification. I don't know whether you've ever used the Deuteronomic laws for your quiet time. You know, what do you do in the case of an unknown homicide? How do you solve that problem? You have to find out which city the unfortunate victim is lying closest to, and then work out who's responsible for dealing with it. Well, how does that affect us in our modern lives? And so on and so on and so on. But there are some very telling parts in these laws. Take chapter 24. And this is a law about being fair to employees. You shall not withhold the wages of poor and needy laborers, whether other Israelites or aliens who reside in your land and in one of your towns. You shall pay them their wages daily before sunset because they are poor and their livelihood depends on them. Otherwise, they might cry to the Lord against you and you would incur guilt. Now, you might wonder why that's eschatological. Well, that's a fair question. But do you see how you have an instance here where the law can't touch the offender? Justice can't be done in the law court for some reason or other. The poor who doesn't get his wages to the next day has, in practice, no access to the law court, or it's just not something that can be easily policed, if you like. So what is said? The law court is there, it's instituted by the Lord to do what it can, but behind the judges in the law court, you have the judge with a capital J, the Lord himself. That's the point in verse 15b. Otherwise, they might cry to the Lord against you and you would incur guilt. Now, what I'm getting at here is a sense that there is a greater justice than the justice that can be done in the immediate arrangements of Israel's life. And that justice will be done. In this cry of the poor, you have a number of things going on here. You have a recognition that justice doesn't always happen in the world. And that was one of the criticisms of Deuteronomy, you know, that Deuteronomy had this very cut-and-dried theology. If you do the right thing, you'll be blessed. If you do the wrong thing, you'll be punished. And it's often perceived as having that very neat rewards and blessings kind of theology. That was why, as I was saying at the beginning, lots of people call it dull and poor and so on. But, of course, it's not like that at all. And a law like this demonstrates it. There's a knowledge here that justice is not always done. But then there's an assertion that behind that, and in spite of what happens in the here and now, there is a judge. With the implication being that justice will be done. Justice will ultimately be done. That's what I'm calling an eschatological concept. Of course, it depends how you define eschatology, but what it's doing is looking beyond the immediate to a situation of in which the Lord's rule will ultimately be established in the world. In which there will indeed be no more poor among you, if you like. And Deuteronomy works with a concept of that, a belief in that as a reality, even though in the here and now there are poor. And you get that within chapter 15 of Deuteronomy. I haven't time really to spend on it, but in chapter 15, verse 4, you have, there will be no poor among you. And then in verse 7, when someone becomes poor, you do this and this and this. It's another little paradox like that one in chapter 7. Deuteronomy works with the realities of the here and now, but believes in the justice of God for all people and all time. And that, of course, is explicated beyond the book of Deuteronomy, as I've suggested to you already in the book of Isaiah. Well, and indeed in the New Testament. So just to sum up in a second or two, a justification of Deuteronomy, an answer to all those questions, all those criticisms that were leveled at it, as I said at the outset. Deuteronomy does not parrot rather weak theological ideas. Rather, it affirms Israel's election, but sees the problem behind it and resolves that in terms of justification, it seems to me. And this concept is developed within the Old Testament, as I said, in the book of Isaiah, but its fruition comes in the New Testament, in which the tzedakah of God is revealed in Christ. What is the tzedakah of God? It's his righteousness and salvation. The righteousness of God is revealed in Jesus Christ, Romans 3. The righteousness of God revealed no longer in the Torah, but in Christ. The wisdom of God, to pick up another word, concept from Deuteronomy 4, the wisdom of God, to whom is given all authority, far above all rule and authority and dominion in this age and the age to come, for the sake of a people that knows no barriers of descent or language. Amen. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. McConville, for introducing us to, on the one hand, on the other hand, two sides of the coin, and for giving us better understanding not only of the book itself, but also our own experience of divine grace, the justification of God, which is the salvation of God. Now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God the Father and the blessed fellowship of the Holy Spirit be your joyful experience today and evermore.